You are listening to Einstein and Gogo on 3RRR. In the studio with us now is Dr. Claire Gordon. Now, Claire is a senior research fellow in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Melbourne, an infectious diseases physician at Austin Health, clinical lead at the Northeastern Public Health Unit, and the director of the Australian Donation and Transplantation Biobank. Did I miss anything, Claire?
No, that's quite a mouthful.
I love it when you get these ones, you know, seven jobs.
Yeah, but it just shows how accomplished our guests are, really. It's amazing.
Great. Yeah, we don't take people unless they've got at least five jobs. Now, Claire, so you're a clinician?
Yeah, my background's in infectious diseases.
Right, so what does that look like? How do you get into a sort of a clinical space where, you know, one day you wake up and you think you're looking at GP, you're looking at anaesthetics, you're looking at various things, you say infectious diseases?
Well, I've always been interested in everything. So when I was considering specialties, I was like, cardiology, that's just one organ. That's just a heart. Okay, that's too narrow. Whereas when I considered infectious diseases, I thought, well, it's not only humans, it's all organs, but there's public health aspects to it, so it's a science aspect to it. So I just knew I would never, ever get bored.
Yeah. Well, and look, any cardiologist listening, you know, you're still good.
No, you're very
important. Matter. It's okay.
You matter. It's okay. It's okay. Podiatrist, you matter.
That's right.
But Claire covers it all.
Yeah. You wanted to do it all.
Yeah. I also found out very early on I wasn't very coordinated.
Ah.
Surgery, any sort of procedure was out.
Yep.
So even if I wanted to, I couldn't be a cardiologist because I couldn't do any angiograms.
And the cardiologists are back. Okay. Now, you were looking at aspects of the immune system. That's why we have you on. In particular, the sort of these non-circulating T cells. So these, I think we just give people a little bit of an understanding there. There's parts of our immune system that zip around the body, and then there's parts that are fixed. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. We say that they reside in the tissues, and they're there poised at the front line, ready to respond. So they're just like waiting for something that's not quite right to start to act.
And how do they differ from the other immune cells in the body, for example? Are they as good, or are they only good at the sort of initial, we'll give it a crack, but the big ones down the back are going to have to take over later?
Yeah, they have several roles, and it also depends on what organ you're in. So we just heard about the skin, how you have to balance between protecting you against invading microbes that come in, but also you're like covered with microbes everywhere, so you don't want to react to those. So it really depends on, whereas the liver, if you do roll the liver in dirt, going back to what Holly said, you would want the immune system to act really quickly. So how reactive they are depends on the organ that they're in.
Yep.
But they react quickly, but they also call for help quite early on. So they, if needed, if it's a big threat, then they'll bring in other immune cells from the circulation. So they'll like, yep, there's a problem here. Come help me, guys.
Right. So these T cells, if the ones I've got in one organ are different from another organ, or are they all the same?
Yeah, we are trying to sort that out. They're definitely still T cells, and within the tissue resident memory cell group, there's subsets within that. And in fact, if we look at one group of tissue resident memory T cells in the skin and think they're the same in the liver, we see how they function. So do they secrete cytokines? How well are they at calling in for help? They're actually very different. And so we think that they're restrained in places like the skin, where they need to do that balance between damaging thing versus harmless things, compared to the liver, where they really do need to function at a higher level. And so we think there's an influence from the environment that the T cells are sitting in. So there's stuff in the skin, or there's other cells in the skin which dampen the response that the T cells are able to do in the skin. Whereas in places like the liver, then they're cue to say, right, be on high alert, have a low threshold to call for help and to respond.
Right, because it's unlikely things will get to the liver.
Much less likely than the skin. It does drain the gut via the portal system, so there's a little bit of stuff that come in. And we do see tissue resident memory T cells in the liver. In fact, we see them in all organs around the body.
Yeah. What does the liver do again? What does it normally do?
It filters, it cleans, it has a really cleaning job, removing toxins from the blood. It has a portal venous system which drains the gut. So anything that comes through the blood that's just been to the gut, like nutrients, fat, for example, all goes via the liver, gets cleaned, and then gets put out through the circulation. And then there's also the systemic circulation that's just going around us all the time. That also goes through the liver.
Wow. So we need the liver.
Yeah.
So don't swallow any dirt because it will.
No, yeah.
But it's always interesting to me, like, when you think about which organs we can easily transplant, which ones we can handle being without. So you can go on dialysis if you have kidney failure. Is there an equivalent for the liver?
No, there's not. You'll need a liver transplant.
Right. Yeah. And you can transplant part of a liver. This is my understanding, right?
Yes, you can. You can split it up. So like a lobe, one of the lobes of the liver could be transplanted. And the liver's very good at regenerating itself.
Wow.
And it's one of the strengths of that, or the uniqueness of the liver. But yeah, absolutely.
Wild stuff. Now, you set up something called the Australian Donation and Transplantation Biobank. Sounds very impressive.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah. What exactly is that, and what's the purpose?
Yeah, so when I started looking at human T cells, I realised very quickly that we needed to get human organs to look at, and they couldn't just be samples that were put in fixative, because that would kill the cells, and we needed to look at live T cells in order to work out, well, what are they actually doing in our body, how do they work, how do we sort of work out the molecules that are important to develop drug techniques. And because the type of T cells I look at are not in the circulation, that's why they're tissue resident, I can't just go to a person and get a blood test. I need a piece of lung, liver, gut, or whatever. And it needs to be fresh.
And they're not compliant there. They're just, like Ailey, she'll give you part of her liver in a second.
Right? Sign me up.
So I partnered with Donate Life Victoria and the Austin Health Liver Transplant Surgeons to set up a program where organ donor families, at the same time they're being spoken to about giving the gift of an organ for transplantation, would they also like to donate to medical research? And this program is really unique worldwide. I think there's only a handful of other places that do it the way we do it. But we've managed to integrate the donation to research aspect of it as through the Australian Donation and Transplantation Biobank as part of the routine Donate Life activities.
Wow.
So that it's very seamless. It's all integrated. And it's going really well.
So in that sense, can families opt to either donate to medical research, or is it or, you know, donate to somebody else, or is it more that, oh, actually this organ isn't going to work as a transplant organ, so that means we'll likely give it to research. How does it all work?
Like so donation to transplant always comes first before donation to research, and so we would only consider or accept samples from organs that weren't going to transplantation. And in fact, we, because we're integrated with part of the donation to transplantation program, we would only be available to sample organs if that donor actually was having surgery for organ donation. So it's a really great opportunity for donor families to really make their gift of donation go even further. Yeah. It's like a real value add, I think.
It's interesting. And just picking up on that point, how much is the decision on the person versus the family, and how does that play out?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, organ donation, it's comes at a real tragic time in a person's life, and for their family as well. People are considered for organ donation if they are either brain dead, so the patient or the organ donor themselves is normally in intensive care.
Yep.
They're asleep. They aren't able to communicate their wishes.
Right.
So the entire conversation is done through the donor family. And I think that's why it's really important for people in advance. You can't predict, you know, things that might happen to register as an organ donor and make sure they let their loved ones know that that's their wish should it come to that.
Yeah.
So how quickly do you have to look at this stuff from the donated organ? I mean, is it have to give you a call straight away? Quick, get down here quickly. I mean, how long do these things last in a lab environment where you can actually investigate the cells that you need to before the organ itself can't be used anymore?
So this is one of the times where I'm glad I look at T cells and not other innate immune cells like dendritic cells. So we consider the samples, or we need to use the samples while they're physiologically relevant. So if you think about an organ like a kidney is retrieved and that needs to be put into the recipient patient in a particular time frame. Mm. We work within those same sort of time frames. I'm lucky with T cells because once I've extracted the cells from the tissues, because they're embedded in there, we have to kind of do stuff to get them out. It's hard to do that in the skin. It takes eight hours to get the T cells out of the skin. Liver, it's relatively quickly. It's an hour. But I can freeze my T cells and then do some really sophisticated analysis later on. But I've had colleagues where they can't freeze their cells because they just die. So they're there all night long doing sequencing and flow cytometry literally all night after a donor. So they might have received the sample at midday, but they'll be doing the analysis at 4 a.m. in the morning.
Every time you mention something here, I hear that you've looked at some of these career paths and you've gone, surgeon, no, I'm not very coordinated. Staying up late for those cells. No, I want the ones you can freeze.
I know,
You made some good choices, some very good lifestyle choices. And in terms of the cells themselves, I mean, how many, you know, you talk about cells, how many are we talking about to do this sort of analysis? Is it tens or is it millions?
Yeah, so when I first started off looking at T cells probably 13 years ago, and we were doing something like RNA sequencing, we would need like 50,000 cells in order to do that. But these days we can look at the single cell level, so just one cell really with some really modern techniques. And so if I have, you know, 3,000 cells, maybe 10,000 cells would make me more comfortable that it was going to work and we'd get enough depth and we'd get enough detail. But the technology has improved so that we can look at the rarer cell populations that we couldn't do before. And that's important with the immune system. We've heard how complex it is. Mm. You really do need to look at that really granular single cell level to work out how it all fits together, because they're all different. They're all doing different functions.
Yeah. Now, your boss, when you're not in here with us, is our very own Dr. Laura, or you would call her Professor Laura.
I call her Professor too.
Professor. And I mean, she's pioneered a lot of this work, and a lot of people aren't aware of that, but this T cell, this resident T cell work is essentially her baby in many regards. So that must be quite something to work in the lab where much of this started.
Yes. And that was, Laura was probably, I was very fortunate actually. I did a lot of my early training at Oxford and Columbia University. And when I've got to return to Melbourne, I've got a family now. And I was like, wow, Laura's here. What a win for me. And just being able to fit into that lab's been an amazing opportunity. A lot of her work has been done using mouse models of tissue-resident memory T cells and some fantastic breakthroughs. And so I see this as a bit of a translational aspect, looking at human tissue-resident memory immune cells to sort of, you know, is what we're seeing in mice actually what happens in humans? Yeah. And as we start to look at things like therapies that target tissue-resident memory T cells, either to make them a better fighter against infection, more active against cancer, or alternatively, if they're going a little bit crazy, being haywire and causing autoimmune disease like psoriasis or vitiligo, you know, how can we manipulate these cells? And because it's such a complex T cell milieu, we want to make sure we target the right cells, because there can be like off-sider effects that we don't want.
And when you look at that comparison with like the mouse model and so forth, it's fascinating to me, because we had a guest on a few weeks back that was talking about the immune system of crocodiles, and there's some consistent elements between some aspects of that and humans, you know, which means somewhere back when we had a common point in evolution. Is that what you're seeing in the mouse model comparison to us as well, that there's some common pieces, but maybe humans are a bit more complex? Is that?
Yeah, that's pretty much what we're seeing. I still think we're in early days with the humans, just because we need this access to the actual human tissues as well.
Yep.
And I think mouse models are really important because you know when a mouse has been infected because you've given the infection.
Right.
You know when they've been vaccinated. But with humans, it's obviously a lot harder to pin that down. And as you alluded to, humans are very different. We have had decades of exposure to pathogens and the environment, whereas mice are bred in very clean facilities.
Right.
They're very, you know, 6 to 8 weeks old when they're infected.
And they're all the same.
And they're genetically inbred.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that we still need to untangle there. But the initial signals is that aspects of the mouse immune system are very similar to the human.
Yep. Now, just before we finalise the details of your presentation and so forth for Day of Immunology, how does all this work you're doing? Because you're a clinician. So how does that play into that clinical space for you? Like, how intense and sort of, you know, bleeding edge this research is?
I'm very lucky to work with Laura, who really takes charge, or we partner very closely together with the science aspect, but what I bring is access to clinical samples. So it's not just the organ donor samples that I've mentioned, but we also collect samples from patients who are intubated with COVID, for example, or patients who have allergic reactions to drugs on their skin, also partnering with clinicians to look at liver cancer and lung cancer. So I'm very much trying to connect the science with the clinicians so that we can start working together a lot. We are already working together, but even more to understand this complexity of the human immune system and how it relates to infections and cancer and autoimmune disease.
Yeah, sounds fabulous. Now, your presentation for Day of Immunology, when's that coming up?
So it's this Friday, same time as Holly. I'm chairing the session, so I'm probably kicking it off. So Friday at the Doherty from 6 o'clock. I'm talking about skin 101, so very sort of basic level of what is the immune system in the skin and how does it, you know, relate to pathogens and the microbes that are just hanging around us all the time.
Yeah, I love the fact that you're chairing the session. So you can sort of say to yourself, can I have another 5 minutes?
I know, yeah.
Yeah. Take your time. No problem at all. Our next speaker, great.
You got 5 minutes.
You got five minutes. Well, Claire, thanks so much for coming in and chatting to us. It's really exciting work and good to hear that. I hope Laura's treating you well. Any issues, you talk to us, we'll take care of it. But it's a fabulous space to work in, and it just moves so fast at the moment. I've been keeping an eye on that, and I've heard about things in the eye and all sorts of things happening in T cells, and you know, it's like, wow. It, you know, 10 years ago, we were hardly talking about it at all. So
yeah, it's very important. Looks like I chose the right career as well. I'm not bored. Never bored.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Claire Gordon, not a anaesthetist, not a paediatrician, but stuck in the immunology space, but loving it. Thanks so much for being on Einstein & Gogo today.
My pleasure. Thank you. Triple.